The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at an historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laugh as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. We've got a shout out to our super producer, Mr. Max White Pants Williams.
Actually, I'm unbreached right now.
Oh no!
Oh boy! Well,
good thing we only see your upper body here in this in this Zoom video.
Yeah. We're a audio family show, so the only nudity here is emotional, and we're so glad you joined us. I am Ben Bullen, joined as always with the one and only, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Noel Brown.
Myth and legend. That's so kind of you. Thank you.
Yeah. What's a gig economy? So what's your pants situation, Noel? Before HR gets mad at me for asking.
My pants are HR approved. I'm wearing a bit of a jean, a dark jean. They're kind of new, so they're a little stiff, but I'm liking them. I'm breaking them in.
You're a jean guy. You're a denimman.
I'm a denimman. Bit, would you say that we are going forth into the breach?
Yes.
Today?
We're
going to breach, do some breaching, unbreaching perhaps?
There we go. It's time to breach and broach a subject that we set up earlier this week with some lovely help from our research associate for this episode, Mr. Max Williams. You might have looked at childhood pictures of many historical figures, especially in the Anglosphere, in Western Europe, in North America, in Canada, and so on. And you might have said, hold on. Why is this really well-known, influential dude as a child? Why do they appear to be wearing a dress? Today's episode is the episode wherein we conclusively answer that question.
It's true. We also do have already in the back catalog an entire episode about kids wearing pants.
Short pants.
And the idea of, you know, short pants and breeches and all of that good stuff. But we're really going to this is going to be sort of a sister episode to that one in many ways. And Natasha Frost over at Atlas Obscura points out delightfully a little missive involving a gentleman by the name of John Neal, who was an 18th century resident of post-Revolutionary War America. And he remembers the day that he and his twin sister were torn asunder is the phrase that she uses. Here's his remembrance. They put me into jacket and trousers, he wrote in 1795. And he gathered up his collection of petticoats and flung them over to his sister. And he basically was gifting these to his sister. And being twins, we had always been alike, he says, till then. But from that time forward, I was the man child. And she, poor thing, only sissy.
And which was something very different back then.
That's very true. It's very true. And then only forced to wear petticoats.
Yeah. And you've seen it. This is for the parents, the teachers in the audience today. You see it all around the world. Pretty much most Western children start wearing some form of pants, pantaloon, trousers, breeches, breeches at an early age. And this is, you know, quite expensive when the kid's growing up. You know, you have to buy this kid new pants every
month. Gotta be tailored too. I mean, this was not off the rack kind of stuff back in those days. And this was, you know, celebrated as a sort of coming of age, you know, a lot like a bar mitzvah or something.
Or a quinceañera.
That's right.
Yeah. And so this is what our pal Max sees as a nightmare fuel tradition. You tell us what you think, folks. You're absolutely right, Noel. This was seen as an early rite of passage. You are no longer an infant. You are a full-on child. I love that you mentioned Natasha Frost from that Atlas Obscura article, which does great work on this. Frost dates this back to the United Kingdom in the middle of the 16th century and says that when early migrants from Europe came over to North America, they brought this custom with them. The custom of celebrating this evolution of a child's life, this passage of time, you don't see this breeching ceremony almost at all in the early 20th century and going forward, primarily because laundry technology improved, which I know sounds ridiculous and a little bit silly, but people used to be pretty dirty.
Sure. And, you know, having a child of self-soiling age wearing custom-tailored pantaloons could have posed a laundry conundrum. Right. Mm-hmm. And once, you know, we were able to use better chemicals and technologies to de-soil garments, it became a little bit less of an issue.
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit, you know, and shout out to everybody who is concerned about the environment and using cloth diapers. We know it's a rough gig, folks. But look, humans are the same back then as they are today. For centuries and centuries, people thought of pants as more than just clothing. It was symbolic. It represented a transformation. It was a statement. And this sounds weird. It probably hasn't aged well. But back in the day, giving the kid pants was seen as assigning a kind of gender role in society. Because now you can climb trees. You can do all the Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer stuff.
That's right. Paint fences or trick people to paint them for you. It's, you know, the origin, surely, of the expression, you know, wearing the pants in the family. The idea of this representing a masculine leadership role and sort of being in charge, you know, being the head honcho.
Mm-hmm. Before this pants ritual, all small children would wear long dresses, comparable in some ways to the modern hospital gown, except it was
a nightie, perhaps.
Yeah, like muumuu, a shift, if you will. And a lot of times when families were not royalty and they had a lot of children, these pieces of clothing were purposely made to be sort of one size fits all. You pass it down to the next kid and so on and so on and so on. And of course, more well-to-do families had to flex. They had to have fancy dresses for their children.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, after passing into that manhood kind of role and being breached, oftentimes, you know, folks in this era of history would still wear what are called dressing gowns, you know, for bed. Like you think of old Ebenezer Scrooge in his best dressing gown, you know, clutching a candle, you know, as he was spooked by holiday ghosts.
Yes, which also I would argue helps the structure of the story because it puts that titan of industry in a more childlike position.
Oh, it's vulnerable. That's a really good point. You know, this is not to get on too much of a tangent, but I read a really interesting thing about how oftentimes villains in fiction, in cinema are seen drinking milk.
Yes.
Because it puts them in this sort of like they are this, they've got issues with, arrested development in some way, shape, or form. And it's also, I've seen it used as a way of representing sort of whiteness as well. Like I believe specifically in Get Out, the excellent Jordan Peele movie where no spoilers, but one of the villains is seen drinking milk and eating cereal separately.
Clockwork Orange, No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
Whenever you see someone drinking milk in a film, it is a very purposeful choice. Shout out to Quentin Tarantino in Inglorious Bastards. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of bad people drinking milk. And I'm sure that the old Got Milk campaign and trade associations have opinions on that, but we haven't called them yet.
Nope. I don't know if they have a number. Is it 1-800-GOTMILK? Oh, that is seven digits. That could be a number. We should try.
Let's try it. let's try it. Because we've got our big boy britches on for this episode. So we can cold call people just like that pigeon that's been giving me nightmares.
We ain't scared.
So, yeah, the idea of breeches, if we go to Anne S. Lombard in her work, Making Manhood, Growing Up Male in Colonial New England, what we see is that this clothing, the transformation into trousers, functioned as a passport to the world beyond the childhood home. You could get into adventures, you could ride horses, you could go on hijinks. And while you did that, just like the story of the twins that we opened with here, while you did that, your unfortunate siblings, if they were assigned female at birth, they have to stay in these dresses. They don't get pants. And this keeps them closer to the home. This is a lot of like Handmaid's Tale, patriarchal stuff.
Well, think about it too. I mean, like so many women's garments, you know, back in history were very oppressively tight, you know, things like corsets. And you'd often see the male escorts and such almost be necessary in order to help the women into a coach or out of a coach because they couldn't do it on their own, largely because their legs are so tight together and they had to be delicately sort of assisted in and out, or crossing a mud puddle in the thoroughfare, you know, in Western times, the idea of a gentleman throwing his waistcoat across, you know, the said mud puddle and escorting the woman across, dare she, you know, besmirch her petticoats.
And the struggle continues today in terms of just getting a nice dress with pockets. Got your back, folks, by the way. We are pro pockets here.
Decorative pockets are for the birds. What's that about?
Yeah. Decorative pockets. I still don't why would you do it? Anyway, so.
I mean, we're not fashion experts, but still, it feels a little bit counterproductive.
We're not fashion.
If it's
going to
be there,
fashions.
make it be a functional pocket. Why? Why not? Why sew it up at the top? It doesn't make sense.
We're fashion functionalists, not fashion fascists. And we're certainly not experts. there is a cool shout out that you found here, Max. One of my favorite books that is so often forgotten in the modern day, The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy. This is a wild ride. If you like Don Quixote, you're going to like this book. It is bonkers.
Yeah, and there is an episode of Breaching that really represents a, you know, push forward into manhood. And there's a great quote from it from the father of this main character. 'Tis high time to take this young creature out of these woman's hands and put him into those of a private governor. Okay, jumping right from a little baby to a governor.
Yeah, and it starts with the breaching. This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Snagajob.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring.
With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs on demand, temp to hire, part-time, or full-time.
You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer.
Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that.
With their easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way.
Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right?
Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly.
Visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert.
Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
You know, Ben, I got to say, one of the best parts about spring cleaning is that post-clean clarity you get where you're like, man, how have I been living like this? What's wrong with me?
You're right, Noel. It's kind of like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan.
It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month.
To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only.
Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply.
See Mint Mobile for details. This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody. Like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right?
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it so. The Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Let's go to Jennifer Jordan, who wrote a pretty comprehensive deep dive on masculinity as it was seen in the 17th century. And Jordan identifies the same phenomenon we're talking about, the social import of acquiring pants. This meant, you know, like you said, you're wearing the pants in the family, you're the young man of the house. It became a huge, significant milestone in a boy's journey toward adulthood, toward manhood. In some ways, not in terms of the ceremony itself, but in terms of what it represented. In a way, it's similar to like a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah. You know, it's a huge passage in your life. And people in the canon of Western literature talk about this all the time, not just in their like banger singles, like in their letters to their friends, the equivalent of DMs pre-internet. Samuel Coleridge talks about it with, I think his son was 5 years old. Is that correct? when he got pants. That's right.
Is it Samuel Coleridge, the guy who wrote in Kubla Khan's Pleasure Dome, Doth Decree, or whatever?
I love that one. Yeah.
It's a good one. You know what's funny, too? Talking about manhood, maybe I'm off the mark on this one, but a lot of these pantaloons were quite revealing in the swimsuit region, let's just say. And often women's clothing were designed to be as modest as humanly possible. It was almost as though the cut of one's breech could, in fact, be designed to accentuate one's literal manhood, mm-hmm. you know, like David Bowie in Labyrinth.
There we go. We're reference rich today, folks. That's how we start 2024. Coleridge is kind of surprised when he's talking about his son's introduction to pants. In a letter in 1801, he says, "He did not roll and tumble over and over in his old joyous way. No, it was an eager and solemn gladness, as if he felt it to be an awful area in his life." So, like, what? The idea is he's five,
area.
He gets pants, and he's like, beat me here, Max. He gets pants, and he's like, shit, it's getting real.
Gotta do man stuff. Yeah. And didn't they have, like, sort of, like, you know, again, like the bar mitzvah type situation, they had sort of gatherings, sort of celebrations of these breaching occasions, right? And there were like gifts given to make the pockets of said breeches jingle with cash or coin to represent the transition of this young lad into manhood.
So one of the first questions naturally occurs is, how old are these kids when they are allowed pants? The answer varies from situation to situation, but in general, it's somewhere between 4 and 8 years old. And it's something like, it's a liminal space. It's kind of like when parents decide whether or not to let their kid in on the Santa Claus conspiracy. The way it's depicted is that there were sometimes conflicting desires on the parts of the parents. The dads were like, let's make him a little man, a little mini me that can go and traipse about. And the mothers were depicted as saying, oh, I don't want him to grow up. Yeah, he's not ready. I want him to be my little guy forever.
And in fact, a historian named Catherine K. Kane had this to say, and this is another pull from the incredible Atlas Obscura article by Frost that we mentioned earlier. Some mothers might try to delay the event, especially if there were no other infants or toddlers in the nursery. So that we know that in general can be the case. Often only children get pegged with having a little bit of arrested development, perhaps, because they are so precious. You know, there's no one else to replace them once they leave the nest, so to speak. So they're often kind of held back a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. It's kind of a stereotype or social observation that can have some sand to it. But of course, we don't want to paint with a broad brush if it's not necessary. We do know that sometimes children might not get pants because of their perceived health conditions. Like, oh, we need him to be on the mend. He's sick with one of the weird medical maladies of our day. He's the brain fever, the dropsy, the shoe foot, etc.
Breakbone fever.
There it is. And
the dancing plague.
The dancing plague. This kid's got moves. We can't put them in pants just yet. Let's see if they can pop and lock and do a Dougie.
Or perhaps a stanky leg.
Or perhaps a stanky leg.
Also, of course, and we've already kind of alluded to this, class continued to play quite a big role in when and under what circumstances a boy was to be breached.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, another thing is, again, I keep going back to this, people are not incredibly different from one generation or one age to the next. So this is a shout out to everybody in the US or Canada who had, as a young child, been dressed in a costume for Halloween without your parents' consent.
Right.
My folks always kept, is a place of pride in their mantle, a picture of me as a pumpkin and then as what I can only describe as a dangerously out of shape French chef.
Nice.
I was like, not even 2 years old.
Remember those really kind of shoddy plastic costumes that like came with like sort of like a smock that was sort of made of a weird rubbery material, and then almost like a reusable tablecloth, but not particularly reusable, and then the accompanying mask. Those would be pretty much single use. You wouldn't really get much hand-me-down action out of those. But the class aspect here is really important because, as we mentioned, these garments were custom made, or they needed to be, especially if, you know, there were lots of differences in size and build between various children. So a less well-to-do family might not have the coin to commission a tailor, you know, to cut a brand new tailored suit of pants, you know, for a young lad passing into manhood. So they might have to deal with these hand-me-downs and for a while, and or continue on with the sort of dressing gown situation until it became untenable. And if there was going to be some sort of gathering or party, it certainly wouldn't be at the scale of that the rich might be capable of throwing.
Here is a cookie. Congratulations, you're a man now. Child labor is definitely
into the field
a
with
thing.
You.
So into the mines, up the chimney.
Or the mines, sure. Yeah.
So it always makes me sad when we have to talk about class this way. It makes me think of things like Hard Candy Christmas, about all these absolutely wonderful, innocent kids who are rightly asking, well, why don't I get the same kind of party? Wealthy families balled out on this stuff. There are accounts of kids being given a ceremonial toy sword. And the historian we mentioned earlier, Kane, talks about how in more well-to-do families, the kid would change into his new custom-made suit, because mass production of clothing, not really a thing yet.
Nope.
And sometimes the tailor who made the little man's suit would be there to dress the boy or the father's valet, because people had valets there. And
a footman, perhaps.
Right,
yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the family would gather in the room. And then there would be another guest, the local barber. And remember, this isn't too far gone from the years in which someone qualified to cut hair was also qualified to amputate limbs
or let blood.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, and it's interesting too, Ben, because I think we've been hinting at it. This really was a passage in many ways, not only into manhood, but into like leaving the house. You know, yeah. Because it you needed to fit into that gender role in order to leave the house. And for the wealthier class, that would be more about being introduced into society, perhaps. But for the less well-to-do class, it might be put off until they literally had to, like we said, go hit the mines or the fields.
It's
terrible, but that is, they would put it off until that point, because you can't really work in mines or in fields wearing a nightie. You got to have that flexibility in the leg areas.
And like literally every other single thing humans have ever done, there was a contingent of people who had a big problem with it. There's a guy who, Max, you call him a clear pill. I think he's a real pill. His name is George Nicholson. In 1797, he writes a book called On Clothing. I want to give him his due. This was the time of stupid long book titles. So congratulations to you on the brevity, Nicholson. However, your weird anti-pants stance is kind of telling on yourself, bro. He said, look, if you wear pants, it's like uncomfortable to pee. And he also said this would encourage self-pleasure. Because, ooh. Yeah, he was like, if you give these little boys pants, they're going to play with themselves.
Oh, boy. But wouldn't it be easier to do that, just lifting up the dress?
I think George Nicholson probably had some things on his own that he needed to address. Sort of like how, like if you read Hemingway writing about bullfights, it's like, come on, dude, everybody knows but you.
This is a metaphor for something that you haven't maybe quite pegged yet. No, that's a very, very good point.
Yeah, well, so, okay, we've got a quote from Nicholson, and Max, I'm really glad you found this, because it shows us this attempt at anti-pants propaganda, dare we say, is during the first and second year, the boy can neither button nor unbutton his breeches, and he is continually in a sad condition. Max White Pants Williams has added, LOL.
Yes, indeed.
Like, what does that mean? A sad condition. Are they in a sad condition because they can't pee, or are they in a sad condition because they peed themselves? Because it just, the way he's saying it is like they can't get their pants off.
He makes it sound like the reprehensible practice of foot binding, which is totally different, but he makes it sound like you're binding crotches.
Well, but also he goes on to say, he takes it a step further in saying, in his breeches, a boy is pent up and shackled, and by way of compensation, his mind is stuffed with opinion and folly. Is okay, he saying bro. This boy needs to let out some steam?
I feel like it
sounds like he's encouraging touching himself.
Exactly. You know? He has this whole part about this dude just has something.
He doesn't quite know what he's on about, if it seems. Right. You know?
He's wearing his unbreached dress still.
He got some bad pants, too, maybe. Maybe he just got a really bad pair of pants and the trauma stayed with him. Because, as we know, scientific studies have been conducted on the idea of pants. Shout out again to Clockwork Orange and the lovely ongoing narrative about the ephemeral cycles of fashion. We know that sometimes baggy pants are it. Sometimes tight pants are in. Mm-hmm. They come and go. And so there has been science conducted on this that shows really tight pants could damage sperm count or sperm
fertility
production.
Issues. Yeah.
But that's like, honestly, guys, that's like reading a study that says insert food ingredient here gives rats cancer. What they mean
in massive amounts shoveled into their little rat maws,
larger amount than any human or any human-sized rat would ever actually eat. So I think there's a little bit of context that we have to approach those studies with. However, and this is something, Max, I don't want to say you're excited about it, but this is something we've talked about off air pretty often for the past few weeks. We talked about breaching, but Noel, riddle me this. What is unbreaching? This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Snagajob.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring.
With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs on demand, temp to hire, part-time, or full-time.
You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer.
Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that.
With their easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way.
Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right?
Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly.
Visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert.
Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah, it was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car, I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one, and that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino, and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it so. The Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
When the Taliban banned music in Afghanistan, millions were plunged into silence. Radios were smashed, cassettes burned. You could be beaten or jailed or killed for breaking the rules. And yet, Afghans did it anyway. This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ugh, into the unbreach go we. Yeah, breaching, of course, was a thing, a ritualized kind of passage into manhood, into, you know, bearing the responsibilities of a head of household type situation. But what on earth is unbreaching? So writing for JSTOR in an article called Boys in Dresses, Matthew Wills had this to say, exploring the biographies of men as disparate as Tsar Nicholas II, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Ernest Hemingway, you're apt to come across pictures of them as young boys looking indistinguishable from young girls. Their hair is long and they're wearing dresses. This tracks. This is sort of the pre-breaching, you know, right, situation. It also makes sense that that's when the barber would make an appearance, mm-hmm, because up to that point, if they're not leaving the house, it would have been prohibitively expensive or maybe like a waste of effort to cut their hair. So you'd have a lot of these portraits having them in this kind of pre-breached state.
Yeah. And this is not like culture war level stuff. This is a matter of practicality for parents pretty often. And, you know, obviously, folks, kids should not have to have uniforms unless they go to like a private school where they make you do it. If we're big fans of self-expression and people arriving at their own identities on this show, so we get the problematic aspects of this. We also know that there were changing fashion trends in the world of children's clothing as we get to the turn of the 20th century. Now we start seeing more overt kind of gender uniforms. As scholar Joe B. Poletti points out in her work, until the First World War, little boys were, like you pointed out, Noel, dressed in skirts, had long hair. The color coding of like giving little girls pink outfits, little boys baby blue outfits, that wasn't really common until the 1920s.
Yeah, I mean, also, there wasn't color photography, so it made more sense. You know, it was black and white, so most of these outfits were white.
I'm still, you know, guys, I'm hilariously colorblind. It's all gray to me. I'm surprised more people haven't died when I drive through traffic lights.
You're not missing anything. Well, except maybe the color of the stoplight.
I did feel bad because when I wore the white suit and then the Christmas party, I wore a green tie and a red shirt, and I did not think about telling Ben that. And so it wasn't until we were on air and Noel said it out loud, Ben's like, oh, that's the shirt you're wearing, Max. I'm like, oh, sorry, Ben.
Yeah. No, I knew the suit was white.
It's good to be able to continuously be surprised by something, though. You
that's
know,
very kind.
I mean, I'm just trying to silver lining it, you know?
Yeah. So there is, of course, there is a lining to this as well. You let us know whether you think it's silver lining, folks. Our historian,
probably lacy lining.
Right. Our historian Poletti here says that children's clothing became more like gender typed. And at the same time, she notes that clothing for adult women began to look, this is a quote from her, more androgynous. And she points out that there was a new sort of hierarchy of differences in color and fabric material. And
trim, perhaps.
Yeah, the way it was cut, right. That would separate boys and girls at later stages. And that you also, she notes to the point about photography, she says, you know, you're going to have a tough time seeing this in most photos of the era, because photographs were kind of like, everybody was kind of like a photograph of Bigfoot.
Right. But also just some of these specifics, you know, were more kind of specific to that society, you know, so we might not recognize those as being gendered based on the standards that we've gotten used to. So it might be something that we would just would kind of go over our heads, since we're used to seeing dress equals girl, pants equals boy. There were more subtleties, and especially to your point, Ben, or to Joe's point about the more androgynous types of clothing that were briefly associated with women's dress.
Yeah, and there's a lot packed in here, because one thing we haven't talked about yet is the tremendous role of folklore, of indeed pre-Christian beliefs that go throughout all communities in the world, not just the Western world as we call it today. There was this superstition that still persists in various communities. There was this superstition that one must take certain actions to protect one's children from infernal or dangerous supernatural forces. So like,
okay,
you know, like don't say the kid's name and these certain circumstances. And this is probably part of the reason why the little boys were dressed in dresses, which is very weird to think about, but there's historical sand to it.
100%. But also the idea of toilet training was important. So to have, you know, a garment that was much easier to change and wash and didn't require any, you know, fiddling with clasps or, you know, whatever, because it wouldn't have been zippers or elastic bands. It would have been like, you know, more tricky buttons or, you know, not snaps even. You know, maybe even things that had to be kind of laced. Right. So it was a bit of a to-do to get out of your pantaloons.
Yeah. The difference, I love that how Poletti puts this, the difference between boys and girls at an early age socially was not seen as important as the difference between children and adults. That was the big line of demarcation. And so, yes, it becomes celebratory. It also, I gotta say it. Sometimes really wealthy parents treat their young children like pets, and it's kind of weird. That's why we get the Knickerbockers. That's why we get the cosplay when some of these children of very, very well-to-do families got their first pair of pants. They got outfits.
And just to clarify real quick, when we're talking about unbreaching, we're talking about all of the fits that went into this pre-breached kind
right,
of period
right. The moo-moos,
of the child's
the shifts,
life.
The dresses. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Until you get the pants, you are unbreached. When you get the pants, you have been breached.
I see. So this is, and also a lot of this stuff would be much more specific in terms of the bespoke aspects of the unbreached phase. That would be much more specific to the wealthy. You know, because they're probably also largely the ones that are going to end up in photographs, because that was a thing
that
wasn't, everyone didn't get to do that. That was an expensive process and, you know, required time away from the mines and the fields to even, you know, get the kid to sit still and you'd have to have the whole crew, you know, to do these family photographs.
And think about it before photographs, like you need someone to paint you. You have to be important and have a lot of money to have. I mean, you probably have your valet and your painter and your something, but like normal blokes like us, now we ain't getting paid in.
Oh, yeah, and unless it was some stylized sort of thing, impressionistic, sort of a portrait of three waifs in the gutter, you know?
Yeah, I like the idea of breaching coming with that responsibility. Like, okay, you're six, you're a man now. We're going to refer to each other by our surnames, right? Here's a gun, and to prove your manhood, I need you to stand still for about 4 hours holding this gun, okay? I'm gonna leave you with the valet. I've opium to attend to. So that's how it goes. All right, I know we're getting toward the end. We do have a conclusive explanation here. We do know that fashion continues to evolve, and it does have a lot of symbolic import to various cultures throughout time and across the world. But I want to give a shout out to one of my favorite weird words. We finally got to use it. I can't believe we got this far without saying it. Knickerbockers.
Yep.
It's such a silly word. Knickerbockers.
Yeah, it is. And it's, you'll see it in, I think there's the Knickerbocker Hotel. I think there's one in New York, and I think there's one in Los Angeles too, but it feels like such a, like it's of its time, you know, this word. But they were kind of short pants, weren't they? Weren't Knickerbockers kind of like sort of ruffled little pantaloons, or what's a Knickerbocker? Is it a look?
It's
style?
A couple different things. There are also, Okay. So yes, Knickerbockers are a type of clothing. They can also be, they're also called knickers, but they can also be a last name. It can refer to part of the Dutch community of early New York, right? The Knickerbockers. It's fascinating. I'm just finding excuses to say Knickerbocker more often. I think maybe we can start using more specific names for pants, you guys. When we compliment people, we can be like, those are some smart trousers, Mr.
Indeed,
Williams.
Indeed, some fetching pantaloons.
Yeah, you've got a
fetching,
knack.
Fetching's a weird one, too. It's like I'm standing up and taking notice. You done fetched me. And here I am remarking upon your fabulous outfit.
You've a knack for knickerbockers, my friend. So with this, we hope that we have answered the question. And if you are interested in learning more about the history of fashion, there is a show with a great catalog that we'd like to recommend. It is called Dressed, EP'd by our longtime friend, Holly Fry. The podcast is not putting on new episodes for a while now, but it's deep and it's a really awesome exploration brought to us by co-host April Callahan and Cassidy Zachary.
Yeah, both of whom, I believe both have backgrounds in literal fashion history, and they go pretty deep into it. And there's a lot of detail and really interesting stuff that even people that might not consider themselves interested in fashion, there is history is forward in this podcast. So it really is, you know, we can learn a lot by the clothes people wore and the kind of circumstances and ceremony around these garments and outfits.
Absolutely. And whether or not this podcast finds you wearing pants, perhaps the most important thing we can leave each other with today is dress how you want. You know what I mean? You have the agency to wear what you would like, unless you know, again, you're in a private school or you're in some sort of situation where a uniform is required, because your clothing is more than just a function. It can also be a statement of your personality and how you feel and how you want to be seen and be felt. And that's a beautiful, amazing thing.
Oh, for sure. Especially now where, you know, gender is such a fluid thing, you know, and that is much more socially acceptable than it's ever been. There are a lot more opportunities, you know, for going one's own way in terms of fashion. So I think that's really liberating. And, you know, for the longest time, as we see in this history, things were very much foisted upon people, you know, because of perceived gender. And now it is very much kind of up for grabs. Like, what direction do you want to go in? Do you want to mix it up? There kind of are no rules. It's just about, like you said, Ben, wearing what feels good and what makes you feel like the best version of yourself.
Yeah, I'd like to end on that point. Again, you have agency to present how you wish to the world, to be seen, to be felt. It is a beautiful thing, and we can't wait for you to join us for more Ridiculous History. We'll be back next week on some brand new misadventures. In the meantime, big, big thanks to super producer and research associate for this episode, Mr. Max Williams.
That's right. Alex Williams, who composed this theme. Christopher Asiotis, Eves Jeffcoats, here in spirit.
Big thanks to our pal, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister. If you also enjoy food history, check out our sister show, Savor, with Lauren Vogelbaum and Annie Reese. Christopher Hasse Otis here in spirit. I caught up with Christopher over the holidays. He's doing well. And you guys, he has an official wizard beard now.
Oh, cool. Really,
I asked him if he knows spells, and he thought I was joking. but
I chatted with him briefly also and let him know that we continue to shout him out in every episode. So huge props to Christopher, who was here from the beginning with Ridiculous History. Also, for shouting out the Quister, we got to shout out AJ Jacobs, the Puzzler. Mm-hmm. Check out his show, too, if you want a daily dose of New York Timesy fun, in short form puzzles for your daily commute.
Yeah, we'll be on the Puzzler in different series of episodes on the way soon. You can also tune in to catch AJ Jacobs in the future with Ridiculous History. No big spoilers, folks, but got a sneak peek at his newest book, which comes out in May, and I am so excited.
Yeah, so same good. Here. I think you got a chance to read a little more than I did, but the peek that I got was a delight. So be on the lookout for AJ's new book. And in the meantime, we'll see you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here, and with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix, then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.